This is Sarah Reif with Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. Today we'll hear from Gwen and Jen Riddell, a pair of sisters who grew up on Greenfield Ranch as children of the Back to the Land experiment. Gwen is a nurse practitioner midwife who works at Planned Parenthood, and Jen is a local biologist. It was a huge treat for me to hear their stories and their insights about what happened in their childhood, which are not always identical. They pretty much interviewed each other while I held the mic and tried to prevent my dog and a rogue ice cream truck from ruining the recording. This is Promise of Paradise, Back to the Land, Oral Histories of Mendocino County. It's August 15th, 2018. I'm Sarah Reif. Can you introduce yourselves?
I'm Gwen Riddell.
I'm Jen Riddell.
And when did you come to Mendocino County?
1976, when I was 5 and Jen was 3. Summer of 1976, our dad bought a piece of land that had no house on it. And we lived in the tent for the summer. And he built the house in 76 days. Is that what he says?
I don't know.
Do you remember that time?
I do, yeah. We had an army tent and some army cots and a picnic table I think Dad built. And then, so we had two tents. We had one and Dad had the other one for that summer, and then he tried to make sure that the house was built before the winter.
What are some of your earliest memories from that time?
The freedom of being outside and just freedom of kind of being a kid in the woods by yourself, kind of raising ourselves in a way.
Don't tell Dad that. probably something very similar, spending a lot of time outdoors, playing with other kids who had just moved up there too. So we kind of had a pack of kids that roamed all over our ridge.
Yes, walking, I don't know how many miles to the ranch school, but it was like a good hour to get to school.
Well, mostly because we stopped and explored along the way a lot.
Yes. And nowadays, I can't even imagine anybody sending their kids on that walk with all the wildlife, you know, and the potential mountain lions. And
I don't think there were as many mountain lions around back in the late 70s.
But the boar, the wild boar, the pigs.
Rattlesnakes.
Did you ever meet any of these animals?
Mostly deer, but definitely rattlesnakes on occasion. I think one of the first things our dad taught us to do is what to do in case we saw a rattlesnake. So mostly just backing off and not interfering with their territory. And then we were kind of on our own.
What was that like, being on your own? Was it fun or scary, or did you think that it was different from how other people did their lives?
I feel like it wasn't scary until it got scary. Like when I fell off the second floor when the parents were not around and I fell to the first floor.
We played together as a group of kids a lot and it wasn't scary. I mean, if there's something happened, like the parents weren't that far away.
Oh, just a ridge over, like a mile away from that, when that happened.
An eighth of a mile. but yes. Yeah, so, you know, nobody was building to code, so there weren't railings on our second story, just like a single rail.
Oh, yeah.
So when we decided to, like, jump on beds on the second story, sometimes it didn't end well.
So yeah. What happened?
And the landing was very graceful.
On the couch downstairs.
Yes. But the other children, and I was one of the oldest of the children, were a little freaked out. And I think they all thought they were going to get in trouble. Because I remember marching over to Edward and Austin's, which is, I think, more than an eighth of a mile. But we can pull teeth about that.
There was a line of us all crying because we were afraid we were going to get in trouble.
They're crying behind me. And I wasn't in pain. I was just like, okay, we got to go tell the parents that this happened. Even though I didn't get injured. There were some injuries. Things happened.
Nothing major, though.
So what were some of the highlights about raising yourselves?
I don't think we raised ourselves as much as we had a lot of freedom and free time and spent a lot of time outdoors. There was a lot of teaching each other things and exploring. That was really fun.
I think it's the other extreme of the helicopter parenting of today, where, you know, we came upon some things that were maybe a little inappropriate. We heard some things that were a little, you know, out there. And
there was the neighbor, the two bachelor neighbors that had a little cabin and a outhouse full of Playboys. Things we like always made sure we stopped at their outhouse all the way to the neighbor's house. Just to explore, see what that thing was.
But it was a lot of, like you say, like we spent a lot of time by ourselves. So things would come up and we wouldn't really have adults to navigate themes and conversations like today. So we kind of came up with a lot of crazy, wild ideas and we had a lot of fun. We took care of each other. We also probably didn't take very good care of each other sometimes. But so, I feel like we had some nice other parents in the neighborhood that watched out for us, too.
So what's an example of one of the things that you kind of had to figure out or make up stories about?
There was one time we decided to try and figure out how to chop down an oak tree with a hatchet. It was right next to somebody's house.
And the parents were not home.
Nobody was home. We just decided that we would see how long it took to cut down a tree with a hatchet.
How long did it take?
It must have been off and on all day.
How big was it?
It was probably just maybe 8 inches in diameter.
I think it was a 12-inch.
No, yeah, it was like this big.
It was right next to the deck, right? Yeah. Edward Monstance.
Kind of took it down.
What happened to it?
I think they probably turned it into firewood, but yeah.
Did you break anything?
I don't remember.
I think
falling.
We got lucky. So. I remember learning. So these neighbors really wanted to learn how to do everything themselves. So we would make butter at their house by like putting cream in a jar, and we'd all have to shake it ad nauseum until we were like really tired of making butter. We learned how to chop chickens' heads off and rabbits, and so we got to watch chickens run around without heads. So it as a literal thing, we watched it happen. There was always the rumor about the chicken that ran off into the woods and we never found it without its head. I think that a lot of this stuff is like maybe things that people have done for a long time and we just don't encounter as much anymore in our suburban and urban lifestyles. It's not unusual for kids to have played off by themselves most of the day and then come home for meals at anybody's house. Like, we would just kind of go to whoever's house seemed most likely to have food that tasted good.
Like an ice cream.
We did not have ice cream trucks.
Yes. We did not have ice cream trucks.
No, we didn't even have refrigeration at first.
Yeah.
For a while.
If we got ice cream in town, it had to be all eaten that night.
That sounds like an onerous chore.
Yes, terrible.
So what kinds of chores did you have?
Oh, so many. I think that we win the prize on the ranch of the kids with the most chores. Maybe
the Mervines.
Mervines. And Kramers.
Kramers, yeah.
Okay. So there are three families that actually, like, really had a discipline in the house with homesteading and put their children to really good work. We did a lot.
I think there were more than that.
We did a lot of wood stacking and moving. So when our stepmother came in the picture, she was really into gardening, and our dad gardened, but he just gardened with the rocky soil. But our stepmother was like, we need to get all these rocks out. And so we probably moved, I don't know, 50 or more wheelbarrow loads of rocks out of that garden and put them on the road. It was like, okay, you have nothing, you have, you know, an hour to do nothing. Go move get some rocks out of the garden.
We had to weed a lot, collect crickets. For one year, I remember one year collecting crickets, work in the garden.
Harvest. A lot of harvesting stuff.
We had a lot of chores around the house. It was our job, so we didn't have running hot water, so it was our job to wash dishes, so we would have the stove going every night, and we'd have the hot water heating up on the wood stove, and then we'd have to carry the hot water over and wash dishes, you know, sweep the floor with the rug beater, no electricity.
What were the crickets for?
To get them out of the garden. We got paid 5 cents a cricket to get, because they ate the food or the plants in the garden.
We probably could have left them there.
I didn't know that about crickets.
They probably would have been fine in the garden.
Yeah. But, you know, we were super spoiled on some level because we had amazing... My dad, when he really wanted to plant apple trees and what was his other, like, obsession?
Cherries, but they never worked. And then almonds, but they also didn't work. Yeah,
but then when our stepmom came along wanting to join, she really wanted figs. So by the mid-80s, we had an orchard of, like, 25 trees. And so... We were very lucky to eat the food that came off of those trees. It was kind of unusual for being up there. I don't think everybody had that big of an orchard. And my dad also planted a beautiful raspberry bush that was super abundant. So I feel like in some ways we were very spoiled with all of the fresh food and fruit, especially, that we got off the land, even though it was a lot of our labor taking care of these things and harvesting these things.
What were some of the games that you played as kids? Like,
probably some of the typical games that kids play.
We built a lot of forts.
Cops and robbers. Cops weren't always the good guys. Because a lot of the industry up there was people started growing marijuana, and so everybody was fairly worried about getting caught, and so there were definitely some raids up there. I don't know if you've talked about those with some of the landowners up there, but... You know, it didn't make the cops the good guys. You know, you were worried about them. So as kids, I don't think we grew up really thinking of police officers as, like, our allies.
We thought we had more fear, I think, of them. And I think a lot of people grow up that way, a lot of poor kids in this country. But I think my memory of that raid that is kind of, it shows how we were taught to respond to cops is the... Sheriff came up in the morning right when all the kids were standing on the road waiting for their carpool. And we happened to be up there with Edward and Austin were the people that...
Actually, we were in the carpool. We weren't with them.
So the sheriff came along and saw the kids on the side of the road and asked, "Hey, what's your name? Hey, how old are you? Hey, where do your parents live? What are your parents' names?" All these things. And I feel like there was this definite, like, ingrained in this, I think he was 8-year-old, 7-year-old kid, to really just not answer anything. And he said, "I don't know my name. I don't know how old I am. I don't know where my parents live." And so I think there was a lot of fear of the sheriff. And, like, fear was like, okay, when we come home, are our parents going to be home? And there's a lot of distrust of law enforcement.
It's more romantic to be a robber.
And do you remember any of the fallout from Class K? It sounds like that was a really big deal also.
We were pretty young, but I remember all the discussions.
Remind me what Class K was.
The sort of bringing the houses that had not been built to code into the fold.
I remember that very distinctly. I remember the red tags and the, like...
Which we didn't get.
We didn't get it because our dad's a builder, but I just distinctly remember feeling a little bit sad about the red tags because I knew, like, some of these buildings that people were building or living in were getting red tagged, meaning that they were like not going to be able to live in them. It just, as a kid, it felt kind of like sad.
They were also like colossally, probably unsafe.
Yeah.
But it meant that we got a septic system, and that also led to things like hot running water, which was super exciting. But I don't think that hot running water happened until after we left.
When did you leave?
Gwen left first. Oh, no, I went to 8th grade in San Francisco.
Yeah.
With my mom. And then Gwen, you left for your senior year in high school.
Yeah.
And I left for my 17. Junior year in high school, too.
I couldn't get out of there faster. I was, like, ready to leave the ranch, you know.
Yeah, it's not a really great place to be a teenager.
How come?
Well, when you're a teenager, you sort of need your independence, you need a social life, you don't have a social life, like, you kind of grow away from the people that you are just your neighbors, so they're your friends.
It sounded like a great place to be a kid. So do you remember a turning point when you were like, okay, I'm done with this?
I think 13, maybe.
Yeah, 14. I remember that our dad taught us how to drive, and a lot of kids knew how to drive before you could get a license. So you could drive to the end of the county, to the Fetzer Road.
And then get picked up by the bus.
Or a friend who had a license. So that got old, and just feeling like you wanted all of your days to be off the ranch. And
there was also some creepiness to it, too. Yeah. Like, part of the whole free love culture was really creepy for young teenage girls. There was a lot of very questionable, and not even questionable, but outright just wrong behavior, I would say, towards young women.
Yeah.
Like, and culturally or specifically?
Both. I mean, if you think about the times, like, you're coming out of this era where, like, women have really been fighting for women's rights, but you also had the free love thing sort of get in the way of, like, people respecting boundaries. And a lot of men sort of took that as license to behave inappropriately towards young women who were hitting puberty. And actually even younger. So, yeah, there was some very inappropriate things that happened, I would say.
Yeah, and it was also, you know, any teenager doesn't really want to be a part of the culture they grew up in.
No.
So there's a major rejection of things. And there was also, you know, we were very well instructed to avoid that kind of behavior, even though there's always the possibility to encounter that, no matter how, like, much you have your act together.
Yeah, but I think that the free love thing, or the, you know, that sort of opening up of sexuality, I think it took culturally a while to start to realize that there really have to be boundaries, especially around young people.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, too, if the no boundaries issue surrounding, like, altered states of mind, like getting high, sort of bled into child rearing or just being a kid. Like, if you realized that there were some adults
who weren't safe. Our dad was pretty good about being a parent. He was a very responsible parent.
There was a moment very early on when everyone arrived and there was lots of marijuana, and it was you know, a very celebratory kind of, like, we're here and we're free. And I have memories of the parents being, you know, doing their own thing, high a lot of times, you know, marijuana being passed around in parties to any age, any size person.
And not just marijuana. I remember lines of coke on tables.
Yeah. Well, that was the 80s.
That was the 80s. The early 80s, though. I mean, enough that, like, we were still maybe in third grade or something like that, fourth grade. There was definitely drugs around, and oftentimes when there were big parties on the common land, there were kids' tables and adult tables, but nobody was really watching to make sure the kids didn't take off the adult table. I definitely tried marijuana well before I should have, but also I think our parents were very clear that they didn't want us to be smoking marijuana and doing drugs. So that was different than a lot of people had. We had parents who set some boundaries.
Yeah, but I think a lot of people, I'm just making a big generalization right now, but on the ranch, a lot of us being exposed to all of this, I don't think anybody came out with, like, an extreme, like, any of the kids, the second geners, like, really that, you know. let's speak for ourselves. I'm like, I really have very little interest in marijuana, and, like, I think it's just been, I've been around it since I was, like, 5 years old, and a lot of it, and, like, we could get it for freely whenever we wanted, and it just doesn't have much of an appeal to me now. Like, I think people that it was very much a restricted commodity, you know.
There were kids, though, I don't want to, like, rat anybody out. There were, like, I know of people whose parents gave them pot for their allowance in high school, and they had to sell it in the parking lot at the high school to make money in order to buy clothes. Mm-hmm. So I know that happened. And I know that there are people that did not have strict rules in their household and did start using really early. And, you know, some people are totally, recovered adults who can control their substance use, and some people aren't.
So what about the more organized part of life? Was there any kind of organization where you were in terms of, political activity or social events, and what were they like?
The ranch parties at the ranch house, I'm sure you've heard of them. They were mostly solstice or weddings.
Thanksgiving sometimes.
Yeah.
The solstice parties were kind of the biggest. They'd be bands and there'd be music, and oftentimes kids would end up sleeping in the cars while the parents kept partying. But we had sort of free range. Oh, we'd run all over through the barns. And
amazing more injuries did not happen in this barn that was built in 1870 something that was falling apart, and
they let us
holes
run through it.
Everywhere in all the boards, probably the nails were sticking up. I mean, we spent hours and hours and hours, and they're playing hide and go seek and hiding up in the hay feeding bins. I remember that was like a really good hiding spot, even though that's like you have to climb up all the. I'm surprised more injuries didn't happen. We were kind of like, that's an advantage of living on the land, is like your body, you're very in your body versus a lot of kids that are, couch / game potatoes. Like, they don't have as much experience practice like in their bodies. We were strong and we were capable, and we could lift a lot and, move our bodies for hours and hours, and we were strong.
There was also the ranch school, which was there for a few years. We only went for a couple years.
Yeah.
But the parents would sort of took turns teaching and volunteering there. And some parents were much more interested in teaching than others. And that was fun.
Did you learn anything useful at the ranch school?
Yeah. I think we all kind of egged each other on. I learned how to read. Gwen kicked me out of her class because I could read early. She did not want me in her class.
She was my little sister. I need to have my own class and feel a little superior.
They wanted to put me in Gwen's class, and she was like, no way. Uh-uh. But I think we all kind of urged each other to learn. So we would walk around and, we didn't just talk about rattlesnakes. We'd talk about times tables, and we'd, compete to learn how to read. And
we were voracious readers, would say that.
Benefit of no TV.
Anytime you had downtime when you weren't doing chores or at school, it was basically just reading.
Some kids had TVs, but we didn't, not for a long time. And then when there was a TV, it was like a 12-volt, 10-inch black and white that got two channels, and we weren't allowed to watch it.
Well, we could watch like Three's Company with the parents when they were watching it, but
Murder, She Wrote. That was the 80s.
Right. Yeah.
What were some of the books that you especially remember?
Well, our dad had developed a really nice habit. So we had to do the dishes at night, and we'd have to, there was a list of things, chores we'd have to do after dinner every night. And he would sit down and he would read to us. And so he started, I think, with The Hobbit. And then he read all the way through The Lord of the Rings. And then he read Watership Down, Little Women, a lot of the classics. So,
Mrs. Havisham.
Yeah, what's that? Pip.
Great Expectations.
Yes, Great Expectations. Great Expectations.
Yes, we read so many classics. Well, he read them to us.
Which was great. He's a good reader. Yeah. And so it really got us, you listened when you're just sitting there working. We'd read a chapter or two, and we'd have to wait. We couldn't sneak. So it was a beautiful, I think, introduction to a lot of those classics.
A lot of literature, yeah. I mean, I just read everything, anything. I was always challenging myself to read as many books as possible and get stacks out of the library. I don't know. Mysteries. Jen was really into sci-fi early on. I wasn't too into that, but Nancy Drew's, anything Judy Blume.
Yeah, I mean, basically anything you could get your hands on. I don't know, then you'd just grab, if you got really desperate, you'd go, read War and Peace or something off the shelf.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you acquired any skills living so far off the grid that were useful to you and continue to be so later in life?
We had to learn how to run the generator when we were 8. We learned how to live without electricity.
And yeah, just take...
chop wood.
Yeah.
I had to walk home from school, which was uphill both ways, 5 miles, snow and rain.
Not a joke.
Not a joke, yeah.
And
yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think we learned independence and we learned resilience. We learned how to do things for ourselves because nobody was going to do them for us.
Yeah, living in the dirt and living with very little light at first.
I've had discussions with people who insist that it's not okay to live without electricity, and you can't insist that people use less electricity. And then, you know, they're like, look at me as a middle-class white woman, and they say, you would never live that way. And you just kind of like go, well, actually, you know, yes, I would, and yes, I can, and I have, and it's not impossible.
It's so funny. People who have like kerosene lamps as a charming thing in their lives, I cannot stand the smell of kerosene lamps because that's all we had for
the longest time. So unsafe.
And I cannot believe more fires didn't happen from those too.
I know.
What's it like having kerosene lamps?
It just smells like gas. And mm-hmm. I mean, you have to adjust the wick. It's this whole little thing.
You have to clean these super delicate bulbs that go around it. Oh, make sure you don't break them.
The number of times we broke the bulbs, I'm sure we got in trouble for that.
But yeah, it's mostly just, I mean, you just learn. It's like any other thing. You adjust, you cut the wick, you make sure it's just right, and then you have to adjust it up and down to have the right kind of light without having soot.
It's not very much light. That's the thing. I really, now I find that I really like a lot of light. I don't like dimness. It's not appealing to me.
The candlelight dinner's not for you?
No. Well, when I'm doing things, I just really want brightness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But. So, yeah, it was fun. When I look back, there's things that I really loved about it and things that I feel like were sort of questionable.
Like marijuana drying in the kitchen? You know, and walking around it?
Or walking around parties where adults were snorting coke?
Well, that's, yeah.
And what were some of your favorite parts about it?
I think the freedom.
Freedom. That's what I was going
to
say.
Learning how to swim and, like, the rule was if you had to have an adult with you if you were at the pond until you could swim back and forth across without any assistance. And then you were free to go wherever, whenever. So that was really fun.
Yeah. And, you know, I think you don't really appreciate it all until later in life. There are some things that were creepy and weird and, like, inappropriate. Like, you know, Leonard Lake, a mass murderer living up there. And thinking back, like, of all of our interactions with him. But then there's something really important that I have taken away in my life from it is community and how much... I just think that that's the normal way of living, is that you connect with people around you. I mean, our dad is definitely a connector and kind of taught us that way of being in community, is, you know, finding out people's stories and knowing little details about them. He always, you know, he introduces a person or talks about a person. He's like, their birthday is, they're from. So it's sort of our dad taking it, that community concept, one layer deeper. You know, you could just know like someone's name and like where they live, but he wanted to know everybody's story.
His nickname for a while was Blurb Kane,
which is not necessarily a nice thing. It sounds like he's just like,
he just liked to tell stories.
Yeah,
they were all gossips.
Yeah. But I you know, our dad, he made friends with a lot of people on the ranch and like really dear people that he had nice relationships with, and Sequoia or the Bowlers or, you know, Marie, all these people that really trusted him as like an upstanding citizen, and you know, he was a trustworthy, dependable person on the ranch. And
you mentioned that they were all gossips, and I'm wondering if that's kind of part of the situation of being community, like so close to your community, if there were things about that community that are different from the more mainstream society that we're all in now.
Well, I think initially everyone moved up there and with the idea that they were going to be independent up there and they were going to be self-sufficient. And of course, that didn't work. There wasn't enough water. You can't grow a bunch of food up there. And I think that's true for a lot of the county. It's like, as soon as you're up in the upper watersheds, those are ephemeral streams, and they're
although
not.
There was the ranch spring, which
yeah,
was
but you can't grow
abundant.
Like hundreds of gardens off of that.
Yeah,
and so people got jobs in town. So there was an initial point period where people were really cohesive, and then, you know, as people got jobs in town, it sort of that some of that community centric behavior sort of dissipated a bit because people had other things going on. So I think initially, people were pretty tight, and there was a lot of like, hey, everything's okay, we all love each other, and then people were like, oh, that guy's kind of weird, you know,
but
about various and sundry
still,
people.
But I still feel like, even like today, like this connection, and I feel in some ways it's a big advantage. Like, we're lucky that we have such a huge tribe and community. And in other ways, now that so many people are aging and knowing all these aging adults and, like, being really kind of feeling really connected to them, it's, like, it's kind of heavy, you know, because, like, as people are getting sick and people are dying, it's, like, this large, large community that we're part of is, it pulls at our heartstrings. It continues to do that, you know. We care about all these people, even if we didn't have, you know, lots of family dinners with them anymore after a certain point. You know, you're connected.